Crawl, Climb, and Tumble with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 13th episode of Robots.
13. Let's hope that won't bring bad luck to today's guest, Professor Robert Full from the Polypedo Lab at UC Berkeley.
Actually, I think he prefers Bob to Robert.
Okay, then. We'll be talking to Bob Full about work he's been doing on animal locomotion and how his discoveries can help robots crawl, climb, run, and perhaps fly.
Amazing coincidence. When Sabine called up Bob, he was just hours away from receiving EPFL Professor Auke Eispert in his lab, who is our second guest in today's episode.
Small world.
Auke will be giving us his views on the work done at the Polypedo Lab.
And now, as usual, Christine is here with us.
Thanks, Sabine. Honda Motor Corporation has unveiled an exoskeleton composed of two legs and a seat, which fits between the wearer's legs like a mini saddle. This novel design allows the exoskeleton to be used simply by stepping into a pair of shoes and lifting the seat into position. It is also very lightweight, only about 6.5 kilograms. According to Honda, a full battery charge can provide additional leg and body support for 2 hours. The device is designed for people who are capable of walking and maneuvering on their own, but who can benefit from additional leg and body support while performing tasks. The exoskeleton is still in an experimental stage and will now be tested in real-world conditions to evaluate its effectiveness. Carnegie Mellon University and heavy construction equipment manufacturer Caterpillar have teamed up to fully automate the largest type of truck on the planet, a 700-ton vehicle used in surface mining. The project will be based on software used by CMU to win the DARPA Urban Challenge and relies on GPS, laser range finders, and video equipment. The automation of the giant truck is expected to provide productivity gains through more consistency in mining operations and to enhance the safety of miners by eliminating difficulties in driving in a mine's low visibility, foggy and dusty environment. NASA's Phoenix lander has ended its mission on Mars and shut down. After 5 months of operation, the approach of Martian winter means that the robot's solar panels no longer generate enough light for the robot to operate. During its mission, the robot lander dug, scooped, baked, sniffed, and tasted the red planet's soil, verified the presence of water ice in the Martian subsurface, and snapped more than 25,000 pictures using its cameras and atomic force microscope. Although programmed to revive in spring, Phoenix is very unlikely to survive the winter, since its electronics will glassify, effectively becoming brittle and cracking below minus 125 degrees Celsius. For more information, pictures and videos on Honda's new exoskeleton, CMU's automation of the world's largest truck, and Phoenix's past and uncertain future, visit the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. I hope that CMU truck doesn't get anywhere near my motorcycle.
Or my Roomba, for that matter.
Well, after an amazing talk by UC Berkeley Professor Bob Full here at the EPFL, we were obliged to get him on our show so that you could all soak up his multidisciplinary approach to locomotion. Ever see a cockroach trip, run over incredibly complex terrain, or even run like a human on its two back legs?
Or ever see a crab walk in wet sand?
How about a gecko run up a wall, slip, and fly?
Well, Professor Full has seen all these things and has captured the mechanics behind these animals' abilities. Thanks to a tight collaboration with engineers, he's been able to exchange experiences with the robotics community. The resulting robots have springy legs and tails and can run, climb, and glide like their biological counterparts.
Do you know he helped in the making of A Bug's Life?
Not surprised, I guess. Let's listen to what Bob has to say.
Hi, Bob. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. And you?
Good.
Can you present yourself to our listeners?
Sure. I'm Robert Full, a professor of integrative biology at the University of California at Berkeley, and I run the Polypeda Lab and a center called CYBER.
And what is the main research interest of the Polypeda Lab?
We're interested in discovering general principles about animal movement, understanding those principles, and then providing biological inspiration for the design of devices like robots, artificial muscles, and adhesives.
And what are your motivations? Why are you interested in these aspects?
We're looking at animals because of their extraordinary capabilities with respect to movement. And we believe that by extracting these principles, we can learn a lot from nature.
You started talking about animals here. I know that you've been studying the locomotion of crabs, cockroaches, centipedes, and lizards. Basically, what are you interested in studying? Why are you interested in studying animal locomotion?
Well, animals have incredible capabilities. The difficulty is that they're really complicated. And so what we need to do is to have a method of study to extract those principles. For example, in animal locomotion, we discovered that 2-, 4-, 6-, and 8-legged animals all move the same way on the ground. They all produce the same forces, kind of bounce along like a pogo stick. So your one leg works like 2 legs of a trotting dog, or 3 legs of an insect working as one, or 4 legs of a crab. And then when we look at how that spring works as different legged animals bounce along, we can get a good idea of how we might build the legs of robots. And we've done that with a number of different robots who have ended up to be highly maneuverable.
You were talking about animals which bounce along. Can you give us a concrete example?
So surprisingly, insects and crabs sort of trot along like dogs and you, all producing the same kind of forces on the ground.
I've seen really impressive high-speed videos from your lab where basically you have a cockroach which is trying to go over really difficult terrain. It, for example, sometimes trips over a while and then is able to recuperate. Is this because of this bouncing feature?
So we discovered that these springy legs are tuned beautifully well to allow the animals to stabilize themselves with very little brain power or sensing. And when you tune the springy legs appropriately for robots, it gives them the same kind of capability of this self-stabilization. We discovered in the animals that when they run over this rough terrain, the signals to the muscles don't even change very much. So that it's very much a process where you just send the signals from the brain and the body takes care of a lot of the control.
And so why is this interesting for robots? Why shouldn't we go for a more traditional approach?
The real advantage of taking inspiration from nature is that it can simplify control tremendously. When you tune the body and put a lot of control into the form and the structure, you then can take the sensory information that you have and the processing capability and use it for much more difficult tasks to recognize things in the environment and act on them.
So, for example, in the case of making bouncing legs, because these legs were designed in such a manner, you didn't have to control them as in such a closed loop as you usually would do in a traditional approach?
Exactly.
And maybe can you describe, for example, the robots you did which were inspired from these technologies in terms of what they could do, how they worked?
Sure. So one of the robots we inspired was worked on by a number of different individuals, including Dan Kotacek, Martin Bueller, Al Rizzi. This robot was named Rex for robot hexapod. And it runs along with springy legs. It can go up to 3 meters per second. And these springy legs give it the same kind of properties that we see in the animal. In fact, the forces of the individual legs are even similar to what we see in an insect. And the initial versions of Rex were able to go over many different terrains, by only having very simple sensing of where the leg was relative to the body, but no sensing of the external environment.
So maybe let's go back to the animal. Something we don't know really in robotics is, how do you actually go about studying how an animal moves?
So what we do is basically what you would think has been done for humans in studying their movement. We do the same thing, kind of like motion capture, where we take multiple high-speed video camera pictures of animals running over different terrains and different styles, different speeds. We put them on treadmills as well, and a variety of tracks, and we get the motion or three-dimensional kinematics. At the same time, we also run them over force platforms, so a sensitive scale, not just in the up and down direction, but also side to side and back and front, so all directions. Or we run them over a photoelastic material, where as they push on the photoelastic material, light comes through cross-polarized filters, and you can measure the force developed. Or we put a accelerometer at their center of mass. And so by getting both the kinematics or motion and the forces or the kinetics, we have a complete dynamic picture of what the animal is doing when it's locomoting.
And once you have all this data, how do you actually go about trying to understand what's happening?
So the problem then is data reduction, given how complex it is. And what we try to do is work with applied mathematicians like Phil Holmes and John Guggenheimer to reduce that data to relatively simple models. So we discovered, for example, this model of a mass sitting on top of a spring, sort of a pogo stick thing, from looking at these types of data. And this very simple model that we call a template can be used to guide our thinking in how to most simply control both what the animal's doing and a robot.
And once you apply these models to robots, are you able to validate them in an analytical way, or you just see, okay, this works?
So the fun thing is we actually do the same experiments we do on the animals. We do high-speed videography, and we run them over force platforms, and we do the same kinds of tests of different terrains that we do on the animals to see what capabilities we've inspired.
So with these springy legs, we've only been extracting one element of the animal's locomotion. And I find it really interesting in one of your presentations, you say that basically a Da Vinci is wrong. Can you maybe tell us why you say that?
Sure. So it's really important. And nature is just spectacular in terms of the capabilities that we see. No question about that. At the same time, we have to realize that evolution is not engineering, and they're fundamentally different. And so it's really important that engineers work with biologists when they're trying to get inspiration from nature because of that difference. In engineering, you often have final goals, where in biology, you don't. And organisms do a multitude of different things, where in engineering, you only often want to do a few particular tasks. And in biology, there's lots of trade-offs with terrible constraints, and you seldom get kind of a global optimality in biological systems. So I always say sort of biological evolution works more like a tinkerer than an engineer, where tinkerers never really know what they'll produce, but they use everything that's there to make something workable. Therefore, in a real sense, in engineering, it's not based on an optimality principle. It's based on a satisficing principle, sort of a just good enough principle. And therefore, like the Da Vinci quote of near perfection, it's just not the case. And so it's the job of the biologist to understand what principles and analogies to extract that are potentially advantageous to the engineer, that is, that hasn't been done in a better way by engineering, and then integrate that with the best human engineering. That's our definition of biological inspiration, not biomimicry or blind copying, but really this working together of biology and engineering to potentially make something far better than nature.
I'm wondering, do you usually choose an animal which could solve a specific problem in robotics or engineering, or do you choose an interesting animal and then basically see how it can be applied to engineering?
So it's a very dynamic process, as you know, and so what we do is we look at nature as this incredible diversity out there, a library of designs. We have a particular problem and we say, what's the best animal to pick in order to answer this particular problem? And we can use a diversity of animals and look at their differences in size, or ones that are very good to measure because of their structure, or ones that are extreme in their capabilities. So we look through and then we pick that particular animal. At the same time, as we study those animals, we discover they can do other things, and then realize that they can also offer something new, and then we go back to the engineer. So it's a very iterative process, a give-and-take process in terms of the selection of organisms.
Do you think robotics can help you understand something about how animals move?
It absolutely can help us because of the wonderful capabilities of engineers with respect to designing devices that can measure things. Our robots that we inspire can actually serve as physical models to test hypotheses in biology and lead to new ideas. For example, when we looked at the design of an antenna in a cockroach, we discovered how they were able to wall follow in the dark at very high speeds. This helped inspire the design of an antenna by Mark Kukowski at Stanford and Noah Cohen at Johns Hopkins. And by their interaction of putting this on the robot, they gave us a hypothesis that antenna, to be most effective, had to convey information that included both a proportional and a derivative signal. We then went back into the animal and recorded from its antennal nerve, and sure enough, we found those signals. And that led us to thinking now about a design of a different type of antenna. So we have many examples of that kind of mutualistic interaction that we think is just essential for the future of collaborations.
You have the opportunity to work with real animals, living creatures. What would you say strikes you as the most surprising?
No question about it, when you look at organisms, the biggest difference from what you see with human technologies is their robustness. Their general features are just very different. In the past, human technologies have tended to be, large metal things that are stiff with right angles that have very few sensors and actuators. When you look at nature, it tends to be small. I mean, the average organism is a few millimeters big. And they tend to be round and compliant and have structures that are appendage-like rather than sort of rolling things, and they have an enormous number of sensors and actuators. This leads, we think, and we don't quite understand this yet, to this incredible robust behavior that we see in organisms that we'd only hope to someday achieve in something like a robot.
Why isn't the case now?
That we can't do it?
Mm-hmm.
I think we don't know the principles by which robustness occurs, and in part it's probably a result of the fact that structure and function in organisms is so intimately tied. That is, that although they're clear module parts of it, that it's very integrated in its development. So you have a unique situation in organisms where they start off being very small, and over their lifetime they get larger, and all the parts have to work as they change. And I don't think we understand development enough, but ultimately that interaction leads to very robust interactions. It's not as if you have a system and then you see how it fails and then you add a safety system to correct it on top of that. There's much more integration, and I think we need to discover these principles more clearly so that we're able to use them more effectively in engineering.
Before, we were talking more about the locomotion of crabs and cockroaches with the bouncy leg, but you've also been working a lot on geckos. Can you maybe give us an overview of basically gecko locomotion and why you're interested in it?
Sure. So we were interested in the fact that geckos could run up a wall at a meter a second. And this was just spectacular. So we took the geckos and we ran them over a force platform and measured the forces. And we discovered some, again, a general principle by which they have a simple model that can explain their motion. And that led to the beginning of inspiration for the robot RISE, for robots in scansorial environments or climbing environments, put together by Mark Gutkowski and Dan Kotochek and Boston Dynamics. And looking at that design, we discovered general principles of how the body works and the legs work so that it can run up. But we noticed, of course, that the attachment devices were critical. Most animals use hybrid attachment devices. That is, they use a bunch of different things like claws and spines and glue and sticky things. And we looked particularly at what the geckos used and discovered that they have these leaf-like structures on their toes with millions of hairs, and each hair has the worst case of split ends possible, about 100 to 1,000 branches in the most complicated ones. And through a series of experiments, we found that they stick actually by van der Waals forces. And then we were able to inspire the design of the first sort of synthetic self-cleaning dry adhesive. Ron Fearing, in particular, is working on that here at Berkeley, and Mark Gutkowski has designed a version at Stanford that can help us grab on. But they've also produced versions of spines and claws to make this RISE robot really effective. When they did so, they discovered that they could climb up walls and incredible surfaces. But in order to do that, they actually needed to put a bar on the back, which is a tail-like thing. And then they asked us the question of whether or not geckos use their tails when they climb up. And, of course, we said, oh, no, we've looked at this, but we've never made the geckos slip. They always were running on very perfect surfaces. When we put them on a surface that slipped, we discovered that they use their tail as an emergency fifth leg. They kind of tap it against the wall as they're running up it if their head starts falling back. And so there's this incredible reflex. And then we wondered, wow, if they have an active tail, which now we're inspiring the next design of RISE to have an active tail, what would happen if they would run up on the underside of a leaf and fall off? Would they be able to use their active tail? We discovered they do. They use their active tail, and they swing it around to do a zero angular momentum righting response where they end up in the skydiving posture. And then we wondered why they did that, so we put them in a wind tunnel, a vertical wind tunnel that blew air up from the bottom, and discovered that they can glide. And when they glide, they can swing their tail to the left and to the right to turn, and they can oscillate it up and down, kind of like a dolphin, to translate. And so they use this very active tail, this inertial device, to help them. So they continue to provide us with, you know, wonderful secrets of motion that we want to use to inspire the next generation of robots.
Any flying robots in the pipeline?
Absolutely. We can't wait to do that.
Maybe just a final note on the future. Where do you see the Polypedal Lab going?
So what we've done is create a new center called CYBER, the Center for Interdisciplinary Biological Inspiration in Education and Research. And we believe that this whole field of getting inspiration from biology is just at its beginning. And we would very much like to continue to develop that and expand it into a variety of other areas because we think it's so important. It's absolutely critical, we believe, and I think we've shown now with enough examples, as have many others, that we must preserve the organisms and their environment in nature. Otherwise, we're going to lose these secrets forever.
Thanks, Bob, for being here with us on Robots.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot.
I love listening to Bob. He's always so excited about all the animals he gets to work with.
And his work seems to have interested quite a few people around the world, including Professor Auke Eisbert here at EPFL. Adam recently spoke to Auke to see what he thinks about Bob's work.
Hi, Auke. Welcome to the Robots Podcast.
Hi.
Can you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, so I'm Auke Eisbert. So I'm leading the biologically inspired robotics group here at EPFL. And what we do is basically relate to locomotion control, both in animals and robots. We use, on one hand, robots to understand animals as scientific tools, And in the other direction, we use animals and inspiration for new types of robots and new types of control methods for robots.
Great. So this work is very close to what Professor Full does, and I understand you know him very well. Why don't you tell us how you know Professor Full?
Yeah, so I love Bob Full's work. So we meet often at the same conferences where biologists and roboticists meet. And I'm a big fan of his work.
Okay, any stories about your first meeting?
I think it was probably... No, I don't remember exactly the first meeting, but I remember he often gives very excellent, very exciting plenary talks. So I guess the first time I met him was at one of his talks where he gave a keynote talk or something like that.
Okay. What would you say is Professor Full's greatest contribution to the field of robotics, maybe recently in the last few years?
Yeah, I think difficult to point a specific one. I think he has multiple very nice contributions. He's clearly one of the biologists who is the most open-minded to collaborate with roboticists and has really great collaborations with multiple roboticists like Dan Kodicek, Martin Buehler, and Mark Tukoski. So, yeah, what I like in his work is things like notion of open loop control of running. I think he was very instrumental showing in his work on the cockroach that he mentioned in the podcast how cockroach can cover and deal with amazingly complex terrain in open loop. Clearly, it's too fast for having a feedback loop. And how then the mechanics and this notion of preflexes that he proposed play a big role in simplifying control and stabilizing the locomotion. And this has been very instrumental, as he mentioned, in the Rex robot, which is a big success story. It's probably one of the most robust and agile robots moving around. What I also like a lot is what he did on the bouncing gates, how to find very generic principles which kind of valid for multiple types of animals and therefore also multiple types of robots, where the same principle can be used by a monopod, a biped, or a quadruped, or an hexapod. And I think that's a very exciting work as well. And finally, I also like very much his work with Dan Kodicek on anchor and template. So it's kind of a nice way of simplifying and characterizing control in locomotion. So yeah, and finally, a nice thing he currently does also very exciting is about gecko grind, mm-hmm. Climbing robots and climbing animals. And there is also very nice links to Mark Kutkowski at Stanford.
So do you believe Professor Full speaks about compliance structures a bit and how they are maybe the future of robotics because that's how a lot of nature, natural organisms work. Do you share this belief? Do you think compliant materials are the way to go, or is it maybe just like that because nature only had fairly compliant materials at its disposal?
No, I think I completely agree, at least specifically for locomotion. It might be different for manipulation or reaching or other things, but at least for locomotion, compliance is clearly very useful. And I completely agree with Bob on that. It's compliance allows you to deal with impacts. If you have a stiff robot, you would have to carefully make sure that you move your robot in the air to lower down impacts before touching, while if you have compliance, it's just taken by the compliant elements. It allows you somehow also to simplify control, that I agree with Bob. Like a simple example is if you have a quadruped robot which has to stand on uneven terrain, if you have a stiff structure, you have to actively compensate and try to make sure that all limbs have the same load. While if you have a compliant structure, you automatically have this four-legged on the ground and the compliance take care of the unevenness of the terrain. Also, this notion of storing energy for dynamic gates. So for slow gates, you may have a structure and it's fine. But if you want to run and to gallop, there you really want to store energy in compliant elements. And I think so far in traditional robotics, we have stiff robots mainly to simplify sensing. I think and to do model-based control. I think the reason why we have so far mainly stiff robots and high gear ratio motors and things like that is that in that case it's fairly simple to measure the state of your robot. You can put a potentiometer on your joint and you know what's your state and then you can do model-based control on that. Once you have a compliant structure where the whole structure of the robot deforms, how can you measure that? How can you sense that properly? How can you then do model-based control? And traditional methods cannot really cope with this thing, because then the model becomes too inaccurate. And I think that has been a main limit so far of having compliance in robotics, is this notion of sensing the state of your robot. But I'm really convinced that with new modes of control, maybe less based on accurate models, we can tackle that and then really benefit from this good properties of compliance.
So Professor Full speaks about developing systems and the fact that during an animal's entire life cycle, all of their sensors need to work, all of their limbs, their actuators need to work. Whereas usually in robots, we don't have developing systems. We have just a finished robot. Do you think this is detrimental? And does this make natural systems more or less interesting for roboticists?
That's a very good question. So I'm fascinated by this developmental stage of an animal, and indeed this constraint that the animal has to be viable at all stages in its during its life. And I'm very glad as an engineer that normally we don't need that constraint. I think unless a few exceptions, maybe space robotics comes to mind, where it would be a useful property that you have a developing robot where due to space constraint you have to send it in a rocket a small device which would then grow and become somehow a full functioning robot. It's maybe the only example where I would see this developmental process being useful in robotics. I think we're fortunate for most engineering application we go straight away to a functioning system which does have to grow or to be viable at all stages. And I think nature has this huge constraint, and I guess it's not so useful to have that in robotics.
So maybe speaking, just as a last question, speaking about evolution and what Professor says, that Da Vinci was wrong and that nature doesn't actually present the optimal solution to a problem, but the just good enough solution. Would you agree with this? Or do you think that there's a lot of problems that are common to so many different organisms, there had to have been at least some organisms that really found one of the optimal ways to solve it?
I tend to agree with Bob, because indeed nature works with this good enough principle, as he mentioned. It's a messy process, so it has this notion of history. You cannot design anything from scratch. Nature designs things from previous systems and modifies them. So this notion of tinker that he mentions. And clearly the biggest problem of nature is this notion of multiple constraints. That's something which indeed completely changes the notion of optimality, because there might be constraints due to metabolism, keeping the heat constant, temperature constant. I think this notion that for then a very specific problem like going as fast as possible for locomotion, that you find an optimal solution is a little bit unlikely. But this notion of good enough is still so powerful compared to current robots that you still find very good principles which are worth replicating. We'll never know if they're optimal, and we cannot. But so far they are much better than what we can do. So there's still lots of interesting principles to extract from biological systems. But he's right to mention that this multiple constraint about for even the morphology of animals might not be specifically tuned for locomotion, for instance. I like this thing. I like this fact that Martin Fischer, a zoologist in Germany, he mentions that, for instance, the morphology of cats might not be only constrained by locomotion, but also kind of things like grooming, removing parasites, which might be as important for the survival of the animal than locomotion. So being able to get rid of parasites, if you're not capable of doing that properly, you might die before you reproduce. So there might be multiple constraints that we don't think about, which have changed the morphology of animals. And it's important to be aware of these. Otherwise, you think, okay, I should copy a cat and it will make me a perfect robot. But there might be constraints that you don't want to replicate, clearly.
Maybe as a last question, at the end of the talk, Professor Full mentions that they're interested in flying robots, but that's all he says. Can you give us some more hints. Do you have any idea of what he's planning or not really?
No, I visited him 2 weeks ago, but no, I didn't know about the flying part. So the only thing which he has a very exciting project on flying geckos. Well, the maneuvers that a gecko manages to make in the air before falling. So it seems that it has some very active maneuvers to stabilize its body and to fall in a specific orientation. And maybe it's that, although that was more, he was there more interested in exploring tail function than flying machines. So, yeah, I'm not sure. You should ask him. Maybe it's a secret project he has.
I guess we'll have to wait for the future and find out.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Aoki. It was a pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, you're most welcome. Thank you very much.
Excellent. That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Our next show will air, as always, in 2 weeks. But in the meantime, stay in touch through our forum for the latest news and hot topics in robotics.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Crawl, climb, and tumble with robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.